Okay, so welcome to class number 7. This is December 12th, 5772. And let's see what we looked at last week. Last week we began discussing, we talked a little bit about Tikkun Olam and how that phrase is used in Reform and Conservative. And I'm not sure if I finished that whole thought. So if you have any questions on that, we could finish that up before we continue, and if not, not. And then we had a long question at the end, but in terms of the Derech Hashem, so we talked about Tikkun Olam a little bit, Tumah Tara, why a body gets a Tara before a burial, and we began talking about resurrection, which we probably won't talk about a lot more right now. A little bit we will. So that's basically where we're holding. So we are in part one of the book, in chapter 3, in paragraphs, hopefully we'll do today, 11 through 13. So 11. I think I'm not going to read, these are long sections, each one. I think I'm not going to read them all inside. So we'll look outside a little bit. But so let's just start with 11, though. Okay, so 11 really discusses the separation of the body and the soul. So we saw that it's been decreed that man must die in order for the whole plan to work out that we've discussed until this point. There does have to be death, and body and soul have to be separated until it's time for resurrection, which is the time of reuniting of body and soul. So during this period of separation, there has to be a place for each separate part to go. So the body goes back to the dirt. It decomposes. So the body goes back to its elements, and then the soul doesn't actually go back to its element, because really it is, you know, a breath of Hashem in a way. I'm sure you're aware that neshama, the soul, is related to the word nishima, to breathe. So it doesn't go back. It doesn't just mold back into Hashem, melt back into Hashem, but it goes to a soul world. So you can see that it is called Olam HaNeshamot. Olam HaTzorech HaZeh Hu Chan Olam HaNeshamot. For this purpose, God prepared a soul world. So we're going to talk about the soul world today and what that is. So when the soul leaves the body, it goes into the soul world. Now, I think that there probably could be a parenthetical part of that sentence, because we do have a concept of Gehenim too, which he does not discuss here at all. So I'm not quite sure where Gehenim is in the philosophy of the Ramchal. But we do understand that there is a soul cleansing period in between the exit of the soul and the entrance into the soul world. But that is more, I mean, the way that I usually explain Gehenim, it is like a hospital, soul hospital, where basically surgery is done to remove the negativity that was acquired in this world. It's an extremely unpleasant process, like any surgery is, but a process that we appreciate, just like surgery, where we would tell a doctor, thank you for cutting us open and causing us pain, because we know that what was removed was necessary to remove. That's really the Gehenim process, but well, probably won't go more deeply into that unless you have specific questions. But after that, then it enters the soul world and remains there in a state of rest while the body undergoes what it must. And during that time, the soul experiences sublime delight. It's really me'ein olam haba. So, and it is, it's flavored me'ein olam haba. It's the flavor of what, so olam haba is not a place, right? It's an experience. And the experience is according to each individual person's experience in this world. So the flavor of Olam Haba that that soul will experience is directly connected to the experience that that soul had in this world, in this on this physical plane. So according to the level that it achieved, according to the level of its accomplishments, that will be the level of its experience of Olam Haba. And in this soul world, which is pre-Olam Haba, that will be the experience of the flavor that it gets in this soul-holding zone. So basically what's happening here in this soul world is that it is a soul-holding zone. If you think about, you know, from when the first person died who was destined for Olam Haba, because not all human beings actually earn it, all Jews are born with a chelek in Olam Haba, it's possible for a Jew to lose it, chas v'shalom. And all Gentiles are born with the capacity to earn Olam Haba. So they don't get an automatic chelek, but they do all have the potential to earn their measure of Olam Haba. But there are people who die who either didn't earn it or lost it. So those don't necessarily get to go to the whole soul holding zone because there's no point, right? They're not going forward. But for those who are, so let's just say Adam and Chava, right? So where do they go? Where is their neshama today? Or where would somebody's neshama, I mean, we believe in reincarnation also, so a soul will go through its processes. But once that soul has finished its work in this world, and before Tchiyat HaMetim, so the soul has to wait somewhere for everybody else in a way to catch up until all of history is finished and all the souls will be resurrected together. Like Mashiach isn't coming to one person. There's no individual or small community Mashiach, and there's no small community Tchiyat HaMetim either. You know, we can't say that just if we'll be from in our own worlds, we're going to get to see Mashiach. That's why we're all involved in Kiruv. Right? We need to get all the Jews on board so that we can get Mashiach to come to all of us. And we need to get all human beings on board so we finish up this whole project of this planet so that then there will be Tchiyat HaMetim for everyone, or for everyone who earned that. But meanwhile, there's plenty of souls who are waiting. And they wait in the soul world, the Olam HaNishamot. So that is a soul-holding zone, basically, to wait for the resurrection. So it's not just a waiting room, right? They're not just hanging out being bored. They are experiencing a taste of the pleasure that they will experience later. And when they're there, they are just there. There's nothing they can do there except for experience that pleasure, except for recover. It's also a soul recovery zone. So that brings us to paragraph 12. So the soul world's not just holding the souls, and not just a space for the souls to exist, but it's actually allowing the soul itself to recover from, So held backness. It was held back while in its body, and therefore weakened, sort of like a limb in a cast, right? So a limb in a cast, you have to put a broken leg in a cast for it to recover, for the bone to knit back together. But meanwhile, while the bone is knitting back together and doing its healing, the whole point of the cast is to hold the leg back from function, to hold it straight so that the bone can knit together. But meanwhile, the muscles are thwarted, and they can't exercise properly inside that cast. So when the cast is removed, the muscles have to recover and get back to where they were. So in a way, when our body, which is like a cast for the soul, is removed, the soul has to get back to what it could be. So what it could be is determined by what it did when it was united with the body in this world. Excuse me. So the soul is supposed to be able to work on, I think we mentioned before, it's supposed to be able to work on giving to the body. And then the body, and it also, so the soul initiates processes in the body. The body then does what the soul requests of it. When the body does that, it creates a positive energy that then goes back because of the body's engagement in that positive thing, in a mitzvah or another positive thing, chesed, whatever it is, some kind of perfecting activity. Then the perfection that's earned through the physical engagement in that activity goes back to the soul. Excuse me, the soul is further perfected, and then the soul is strengthened, and it should be able to beam a perfecting energy back into the body. That's separate from the causative process, separate from its ability to cause the body to do a mitzvah. When it receives the goodness, the spiritual goodness from the result of the mitzvah, it actually strengthens the soul and makes the soul, if you want to just use this as an analogy, shine brighter. And the brighter shining should be able to infiltrate the body, infiltrate the physicality of the body, and refine the body through the shining. Does that make sense so far? Do you understand what I'm talking about? I'm going to take your silence for a yes. You get it.
I have one question, Aliza.
Okay.
Just a clarification, I think. Did you say what happens to the souls that don't that lose their, let's say the Jewish souls that lose their place in the world to come. Did you say where they go?
I didn't say where they go. They actually experience destruction. And that
destruction?
Yeah, they do. So it's possible. I mean, if they actually lose their chelek in Olam Haba, let's say an Achmi Danadad.
That happens through?
Who some people say might be Jewish. right? So if he is, Chas V'Shalom, so he is destroying his soul by what he's doing. So then the soul actually, just because, I mean, hopefully if somebody's born Jewish, they have enough energy to bring themselves to a positive place, but it's all based in free will. So a person is able to choose themselves out of Olam Haba, and certainly they can choose themselves out of Olam Hazeh, but they can choose themselves out of Olam Haba through their Olam Hazeh, just like we can choose ourselves into a much, much stronger place. It's all the result
of our
choice.
So what are the chataim that cause one to lose their Olam Haba?
There are chataim that cause one. So, I mean, I'm not exactly sure what karet is, you know, the spiritual excision of the soul.
Right.
If one doesn't do proper tshuva for that, what does that mean permanently? You know, if somebody dies without that. So there are certain things. There's Yisurim, and there's death, and there's Gehenna, which can also affect levels of kapara. So it could be, depending on what a person did and depending on the person's desire, that even if they didn't do proper tshuva, even if it wasn't proper tshuva, but some kind of harata, some kind of tshuva, plus death, plus suffering, plus Gehenna would probably do the trick for some. And for some, it wouldn't. You know, for a real Rashaim, who are genuinely Rashaim, people who are machti at the rabim, people who could never, ever, ever do tshuva, their souls are destroyed. But it's not like the person dies and it just fades to black. Because you might say, well, what's the big deal? I'll do whatever the heck I want, right? I mean, Russia could say, I'll do whatever the heck I want, and there'll be nothing to pay. My soul will be destroyed. I'll just be done. But that can't be either, because Hashem is perfect and there is justice. So absolute justice will occur. It can't occur in this world. It's not possible for there to be absolute justice in this world because there aren't the kalim for it. Just as a, for instance, just looking at it in the extreme, if you look at a Hitler, it is not possible in this world for him to pay for what he did. He can't suffer enough. He can't die enough. It's not possible for him to suffer enough in this world to pay for his crimes. But he is paying, and he will suffer to pay for all of it until he's paid. And after he's paid, then his soul is destroyed. There's nothing left for him after that. So that's for total Russia, like that. For a Russia, everybody pays for what they did, and everybody gets paid for what they did. So everybody gets paid for the good and pays for the bad. That's why that is the root of one of the reasons why we say something like kapara when something breaks or we lose something or whatever it is. Because we'd rather pay in this world than in the next. The payment is much easier here than it is after our soul and body are separated. So we'd rather pay here if possible. So whatever negative thing happens, there should be a kapara. We hope that it's a kapara. But for those people who can't pay in this world, it's all in the next. And then for those people who there's nothing left to save, they got paid the good here. And then there's nothing left. Once they receive their reward in this world, and then they pay the price after they die, and then there's nothing left for eternity. It's just then, after that point, the soul is destroyed.
So that's in the Olam HaNeshamas, the destruction of the soul?
I'm not sure.
You're not sure? Okay.
Yeah, I don't know where the destruction actually occurs.
Okay.
I wouldn't think, from what I understand of the Olam HaNeshamas, that it would happen there.
Uh-huh.
Because the function of the Olam HaNeshamos is to be a happy place. It's where you're receiving the good that's left over. Yeah, so it can't be in the Olam HaNeshamos because that is only the good where you... Good is eternal and bad is a construct. So once the bad is removed, only good lasts. and the good lasts forever. That's not used up. So what you're doing in this world when we do good things, that's why there's not a cheshbon. That's why it's tricky. We talked earlier about the image of the scale and good and bad. So we are supposed to think about our deeds on a scale and that one more deed will tip it to the good or to the bad. But the risky part of that is thinking that there is a balance between the good things that we do, or that there's a cheshbon between the good things that we do and the bad things that we do. They're totally separate things, that the good creates a kli to receive Hashem, and the bad things don't necessarily negate that kli. They just create debt to pay, in a way. But they don't necessarily, except for some things, Lashon Hara, for instance, that can affect the actual kli itself. But the other negative things that we do don't necessarily affect the good kli that we're building with the good things that we do. They just incorporate negativity into us that has to be removed before we can utilize that kli. But they don't cancel each other out. So the Olam HaNeshamos is the place where the kli starts to receive. So it starts to feel the receiving energy. But really what's going on there, I mean, there's really kind of three things that are happening there. let's see, should we get to that already? Well, let's just look a little bit more in 12, and then before we sum up with the three things that happen in the Olam HaNeshamos. So basically what 12 is describing, and it is a very long section there, is that the soul is supposed to be able to shine brighter every mitzvah that the body does. So the soul causes the body to do a mitzvah, the body then does it, and that brings positivity back to the soul. The soul should be able to shine brighter every time the body does a mitzvah. But it can't, because of that initial sin, it's not possible for the whole process to really function appropriately. There does have to be death, there does have to be a separation, and the body can't be perfected to a place where it becomes immortal. Because if the soul would be able to shine properly, the body would be perfected to a stage of immortality, which can't happen in this first stage. So the body suffers because of that, because the soul can't shine and it can't refine the body. So the body remains in this thick, heavy state that we're in as we plod through the world, because it can't be properly purified by the soul. But the soul also suffers. So these are two key points that I want to make here. So I'm on page 81 in my volume in the Pathways to the Way of God book that I'm using. Excuse me. So then that's in the middle of paragraph 12, in the middle of section 12. So the soul loses because the soul can't function the way it's supposed to. So it loses in two ways. One is because it can't do what it's created to do, which is to perfect the body. But the reason why it's supposed to perfect the body is because the soul is created in the image of God, and God is a giver. God gives good. So the soul, created in God's image, is supposed to be able to give good to the body. And so the body suffers because it can't receive the good that the soul is supposed to be able to give, but the soul suffers because it can't give good, A, and because it can't behave according to how it's created, B. So in those two different ways. So these are key points to keep in mind, that we suffer if we can't bestow good. Giving good is good for us, and we suffer when we can't. And behaving according to how we're created is good for us, and we suffer when we can't. So that is something important to understand, but that's why the soul is suffering in this world, because it can't properly give and it can't properly exercise itself in the way that it was created. So that's hard on the soul. And that causes the soul to atrophy a little bit. Now, it's not a permanent atrophication, I don't know what's the right word. It doesn't atrophy permanently, but it does. Excuse me, it being held back like that so that it can't give properly and it can't function according to the way it's supposed to does cause the soul to weaken. Right, so that's a hard thing on the soul, and then that's hard on the body too. So what happens when the soul exits the body and then whatever happens in between and then enters the soul world it then begins to radiate freely. So imagine it's like those screw-in fluorescent light bulbs, right? When you turn those on, they're not as bright as they are about 5 minutes later. Have you ever seen that experience? Not like the tube fluorescent light bulbs that turn on right away. I mean, they like blink once or twice, and then they turn on right away. And not the incandescent light bulbs that turn on in their full strength right away, but the spiral fluorescents, when you turn them on, they take a minute or two to come to their full strength. The full strength of their potential is there the moment that you turn it on, but it's not able to shine its full strength until it warms up or whatever it needs to do scientifically. But basically, that's what's happening with the soul. The soul goes into the soul world with the full potential that it accomplished in this world through its deeds with the body, but it can't yet shine. It's been held back from the shining. So part of what's going on in the soul world is the soul kind of warms up and shines brighter and brighter and brighter and brighter until it shines at the level of potential that it accomplished through the physical. So it's a soul recovery zone. So it's a soul holding zone and a soul recovery zone. It recovers its brilliance. It's able to shine up to its brilliance. So basically what it's doing, there are three things that's happening for the soul in the soul world. One, it starts to shine. So it's finally released from the shackles of the body. And now it's able to shine like it's supposed to. So that's just like an exhale. Phew, what a relief. I'm not held back by the body anymore. That's level one. Level two is it starts to shine up to where it could. So it shines brighter and brighter. So it regains the power that it lost while it was associated with the body. And then three, that gets it ready for its next step, so that when the resurrection comes and that fully brightly shining soul, as bright as it can be according to what it accomplished, is then dropped back into the body, then it's not held back. During the resurrection, it's not held back from its ability to shine and refine the physical. It's dropped into the physical and immediately refines the physical body that it inhabits and brings the body directly in line with the spiritual, to make it directly reflective of the spiritual enlightenment the soul is able to gift it with. The soul is then able to actualize its ability to give to the body and bring the body to the spiritual level of the soul. Okay, I'm pausing for a minute. You can interrupt me at any time.
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
It sounds in a certain way that, like, the neshama and the body act as the being, so to speak, and it's azer connecto.
Not quite. Let's see. Azer connecto. Nope, I wouldn't say that. I would say because ezer kenegdo, so if you think about the Rashi, so Rashi says ezer zocha ezer, lo zocha kenegdo, right? If the husband merits, she helps him, and if he doesn't merit, he's against her, because it's a strange phraseology, the ezer kenegdo concept. How does that work? So it's not that way. I would say it's more, if you think about ezer kenegdo as being somebody that assists in the process of bringing one to their full potential, then it wouldn't be the body that's doing that for the soul, or either the soul that's doing that for the body, but rather the body and the soul work together, and it would be this world that acts as that, as sort of the obstacle course for the body and soul together. Because they are a team. I mean, I guess in that sense it could be an ezer kenegdo. They're a team, but there's no, I'm trying to think. I mean, in a sad marriage, I'm not going to say it's unhealthy or unproductive, because, you know, sometimes Hashem arranges it for reasons. And so in a difficult marriage where one person would be providing extremely difficult circumstances for the other one to have to work through and grow through. So I could see some type of analogy there where the body would be the difficult circumstance for the soul to grow through, but it's not really. It's just that the body was transformed by that first sin so that it can't be immortal in its current state, but it's supposed to be. So it does have to go through a process of decomposition first where it returns to the elements and then can be newly assembled. So it's a fresh body for the soul to go into, and then the soul is able to actualize itself by giving to the body. So they are a team. I'd say the only real way I could see them together is that they are a team. But, yeah. Okay, so let's look at 13. So 13 says, even before the soul enters the body and attains perfection through its deeds, it already has a high degree of intrinsic perfection. So now we're talking before the body is born, right? So this is not after death. This is before birth. So even before a soul enters the body and attains perfection through its deeds, through the body's deeds, right, through this life, it already has a high degree of intrinsic perfection. This intrinsic perfection and brilliance is so great that it should be able to purify man's physical being to such an extent that he no longer be considered a mortal human being. So that's right away. It should be that at ensoulment, which we understand as 40 days after conception, that when the soul comes into the body, that it has such a high degree of intrinsic perfection that it should instantly be able to transform that body into so that it's no longer like us at all, not a mortal being at all. However, that's not what God wanted, and so it's held back by God's decree. So it's just that it could do that, except for the fact that God held it back by divine decree. So it has the power that God said no for now. So its power is obstructed and its brilliance reduced so that it cannot do everything in its power to accomplish this. The soul thus remains imprisoned and restrained to the degree required by God's plan. And it can only act upon the body to the extent that God's wisdom allows. So in a way, but just in a way, and I guess this isn't a fully formed thought, but in a way, it's like a Hester Punnim. I mean, there's a need for Hester Punnim in this world, for God's face to be hidden, and for the sake of the revelation of God's oneness at the end of the whole process. We wouldn't be able to see with clarity how all the threads tied together if we didn't see separate threads along the way. So with separate threads along the way, if you just think about the story of Esther, for instance, you see so many separate pieces along the way, and it's not till you finish the whole book that you get the story that, oh, yeah, everything was leading up to this, right? How did building the gallows work, and why did he have to have insomnia that night, and why was there a party, and why did they call the queen, and why, you know, all those different things are separate threads, and you wouldn't see the unity of all of them being pulled together and be able to see God so clearly in the picture if you didn't see separate threads. So the revelation of God's oneness has to be held back. God is one. So God's oneness has to be hidden in order to see separate so that you can then, in order to see separate, let's just end the sentence right there. God's oneness has to be held back. It has to be hidden in order to be able to perceive separateness. If God's oneness wasn't held back, we wouldn't see anything except for one. So in order to perceive separateness, God's unity has to be held back. In order for us to be able to accomplish what we need to accomplish, we have to have free will. So we can't perceive God's unity yet. That would get in the way of the program of us using our free will to accomplish what we need to accomplish. But the end of everything will be the revelation of God's unity. So it's held back. So in a way, you could think about the soul, there's not the unity there, but that the soul's brilliance has to be held back. Otherwise, the body and the soul together as partners couldn't accomplish what they need to accomplish. It wouldn't be possible. If the soul, with whatever it had initially, it is able to perfect the body, but if it was allowed to use that energy to perfect the body, then it wouldn't have the body as a tool. It couldn't go through this world and use the world to perfect itself and elevate itself. It would already be on such a high level that it would be a whole different function. So the soul's energy is held back. It can't function freely until it reaches the soul world. So it's altogether held back. However, when it's finally recombined with the body after the resurrection, it will no longer be bound or restricted by that decree. That decree will be lifted, and it will enter the body with all its brilliance and strength. And then the body will immediately be transformed and shine. So here he says clearly in the text, it won't develop gradually as a child now does. Will immediately shine forth and purify it to a very great degree. So we talked about earlier how Chabad, I think just as a mushel, has this concept that we'll be resurrected at age 19, right? So that it's not that we're going to be born and grow, and it's not that we're going to be resurrected how we're put into the grave with whatever missing pieces we have or with whatever sick parts we have. We'll be resurrected like a 19-year-old, somebody who's in their physical prime and already grown up. So already grown up, but not yet plateaued and not yet deteriorated. 19 is that, like, that nice point, like right in between. I guess today it's not in between the follies of youth, but it's still in the folly of youth. But that's a nice full-grown body before it starts to slide down. So that's the concept of Chabad, but it's just a mushel, really, because here, this is what it's saying, is that let's just imagine it's a physical hulk that's that initial body. It's not like it's a body that looks like ours, but just like a, let's just imagine a bundle of cells or something, and then the soul is dropped into it. Imagine the way it works even right now at 40 days of gestation. What is the body, really? It's nothing that looks human-shaped at all. You can look that up online. You can see the different stages of gestation. And 40 days of gestation is nothing. It's not even like a grain of rice. You can't, it's tiny, but it's not different. It doesn't have the shape that's anything like human. And then the soul comes into it. So imagine you have that, whether it's that size or not, the soul comes into that blob of cells, but then it doesn't require the gradual development as a child now does. That's what he says in the text. It will not have to develop gradually as a child now does. It will instantly shine forth and purify the body to a very great degree. So it will be a total transformation, immediately reflecting the level of the soul. And I tried to find more information on this part, but I didn't yet. So it says here, this does not mean, however, that the resurrected man will not be able to continue to elevate himself. The instant that the soul re-enters the body, the individual is raised to a high spiritual level and the body experiences its initial enlightenment. At this point, the body will immediately be on a higher level than it could possibly attain in its first life. And the degree of development will depend on the individual's good deeds in his first life. And, this level is not permanent. The complete man, both body and soul, will still be able to elevate himself in relation to the initial level upon which he is placed. I'm not exactly sure how that's going to happen. And I looked up in a few different places to see, you know, if somebody discusses that. How could there be elevation after the resurrection? So I'm not clear on that. So I can't really explain how that might work. And the note in Arya Kaplan just says it's because of that that it says tzaddikim have no rest. Meaning what? They have to keep going? I don't know what it means exactly. So I do want to do some just more looking into that. But that's what the Ramchal says here, is that you do have that. But that's just an initial level for post-resurrection, but that you can keep going in your development after that. So again, I'm just not sure what the means of development are at that point. That's going to require some additional learning on my behalf to get there. Any questions up to here?
That's really, really heavy stuff.
Yeah. Shall we continue a little bit, or should we end it here, do you think? I mean, and the Ramchal part here, because I have one more thing to bring up. Well, since we're at the, I think we're at the end of this chapter, so let's end the Ramchal part for here. But I do want to bring up one thing that we looked up, and we looked at in the, I teach Sefer Chinuch on Monday mornings, and so today we were up to the mitzvah of Peah and Leket and Shechacha. There's eight in a row. They're listed in positive and then negative. Do leave a Peah, don't harvest your whole field. Do leave behind the Leket, don't pick up all the stuff you drop. Do leave the Shechacha, don't re-glean, you know, don't re-go over the field. So it's do and don't. So it's interesting about a vineyard. You're supposed to leave behind a certain amount of grapes. There's supposed to be a Peah also, but then there's certain stuff that you're supposed to leave behind, and it says you're not allowed to, and there's a machloket over exactly what that looks like between the Rambam and the Ramban, but that's not the part that I want to bring out. What you're not allowed to do in when harvesting olives, let's say, you're not allowed to spread a blanket under the tree and then shake the tree and then pick up the blanket, meaning you get everything that came off. You have to pick, you have to harvest it in a way that something's going to fall off for the poor person that you can't get. And the same thing with the grapes. You're not allowed to put a basket under the grapes and then clip, clip, clip all the, what are they called? All the bunches of grapes, all the eshkols, right into the basket, because then nothing's going to fall off. It's supposed to be that when you clip one of those bunches, the single grapes that fall off the bunches while you're taking it from the vine and putting it into your basket, those ones that fall onto the floor are for the poor person. You're not allowed to pick them up. So you might think, well, it's an interesting thing, you might think that you're wasting time. You know, it takes so long to harvest that way. And, you know, wouldn't it just be easier to put a basket under it all and then just start snipping with your scissors and get it all, that the Torah is requiring you to waste time in your harvest? Or why couldn't you just make an extra tithe instead of doing that? But I think the very point of it is that if you think that the goal of harvesting grapes is to get the grapes, then you're missing the whole point. The goal of harvesting the grapes is to grow your soul. And the grapes are just a means to that. Everything here is to grow your soul. And so we have to understand that everything that we do is a means to soul growth. So that means that when you're harvesting, whether it's you, the owner of the field, or the person that you hired to harvest, it means that every single time that you reach your hand forward to take that bunch of grapes, clip it, and put it in the basket, you have to think about the halachas. You have to be aware, sort of like making a salad on Shabbos. You have to be really conscious the whole time to make sure that you don't transgress, because it's not about just getting the grapes into the basket. It's about growing your soul through the process. It's how do you use this world to transform your soul. And therefore, there is a way to harvest grapes that will leave behind something for a poor person to have, and then you accomplished at the end of the field, when you at the end of your harvest and you have a basket full of grapes, so now you have something to eat and you have something to make a parnasa from and you've grown your soul through the process. You've accomplished what you're supposed to accomplish rather than having the mistake of the goal being just the parnasa, just the food. So I think that it just made me think about tying into this whole soul thing that we have to look at the world as soul growth opportunities, every part of it, how we cook and how we eat and how we drive and how we cross the street and how we smile at somebody. It's not just how can I get there, but it's how can I grow my soul while I'm going there, right? That's really the destination, is the most soul growth possible, and everything else is just a vehicle to that. So I just wanted to share that from the Sefer Chinuch. And what else? Do you have any questions in Kiruv that you're doing, or thoughts that you had, or questions on anything else from the week? Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, do you?
No, I'm just saying thank you very much.
Oh, okay. So we'll sign
thank
up for tonight.
Thank you very much, Elise. I'm sorry. I have to be on mute just there's a lot of background noise here, but thank
no
you very,
problem.
Very much.
No problem. It's my pleasure. And if you have any questions, just email me or ask them next time or whatever it is. But meanwhile, have a great week, and we'll talk in a week.
Thank you.
Okay.
You
all
too.
Right. Call to okay. Bye-bye.